Session number 9278.
Mr. Cotman, real form.
Yes, he got by pinching cars in South Africa and taking odd jobs in fairgrounds and working dodgem cars and things like that. There were one or two quite politically motivated people. Funnily enough, one of them was a chap called Frankford, who had the reverse experience to myself, whereas although I belonged to the Young Communist League and not the the ILP, I was still of the opinion that it was right to conduct the war with the defence of Madrid as the top priority. And Frankfurt and I had differences of opinion about that. And we finished up the war with totally different views on it. I was quite against the orthodox communist position, but Frankfurt by that time, although he was anti in the first place, went right over. And for a long time anyway, he was an open advocate of the communist position in Spain.
Being what? You mean the defence of Madrid?
Yes, it was. The main issue was this: whether to develop the revolution with parallel with the war, which was the Poom's policy, or whether you should forget about the revolution and concentrate on the defence of Madrid as it was then, which was the communist position. But to put it like that is a bit simplistic, because what most people don't realise is that the revolution had happened and that the Spanish people had already taken over factories, town halls, transport and everything that mattered, and they weren't giving it up. And it was particularly naive of the communists to think that they were going to.
Did the communists advocate that they should give it up?
Oh, yes. You'd give it up to some cases, restore it to the people that had it before, but mainly the friends of the communists, people who would influence events for the communists. They got communists or fellow travellers, as they're sometimes known as, appointed in the police, all sorts of places that it mattered, with a view to influencing future events and taking the power away from the people that had it, which was usually a workers' committee. And of course, in the north, in Catalonia, the workers, which is to say, particularly the anarcho-syndicalists, weren't releasing it. They weren't giving it up.
Picking up your own story, we left you at this village of
Alcabira.
Where did you go on to from there?
Well, we went up in Alcabira. We lived mainly in caves, quite surprisingly comfortable. They weren't as damp as one might imagine. We were there, I don't know, might have been a month or two, perhaps a month, a little more. And from there we went on to positions outside Huesca, Huesca. There are two big towns in the north. One is Huesca and the other is Zaragoza. We were positioned outside Huesca. The Huesca itself was in the hands of the fascists, so that the front bordered the town.
Can you describe the positions that you took up?
Well, the land was mainly flat. Some of it had been cultivated, potato fields. fields and things like that. We were outside a little place called the Grange in England, La Granja in Spanish. And this was quite comfortable. We slept in lofts and barn-type places. Again, not uncomfortable by any means. Pretty well sheltered. It wasn't too cold by then. I mean, providing you had greatcoats and blankets, you could sleep pretty well. Some people did feel the cold. I wasn't conscious of the cold much, probably because I was young. And, you know, how you don't sort of, I probably feel it now, but George Orwell certainly felt it. But he was older, you see. But bearing in mind places that I'm in, since it was fairly comfortable from the point of view of, you know, external environment. It's amazing when you go to camps, for example, today, holiday camps. They're not much more than a hut. And these places were similar, sort of hut kind of thing, except it was barns, outbuildings. And providing the cold, you could stand the cold, you're right. We had palliasses, as they call them, straw square things that is fairly common practice in the army and the air force today. They have about three of them. Often the blokes often call them biscuits, you know, because of their shape, and you put three of them and you can lay fairly comfortably on one. I remember palliass because in getting the translation of it, it was seemed to be like Pagliacci, the straw man in Italian. But they were quite comfortable to sleep on. We were a bit lucky in that sense that we weren't in open, muddy trenches, you know.
What about your rations and food?
Well, there was only one reliable, comfortable time you could eat, and that was breakfast time, I found, when you got... they cooked it in sort of biggish cauldrons, which might sound unattractive, but it was milky coffee, and it was really good. Nice, strong coffee, and you could have it sweetened if you liked. Most of us did. And some of these long, hot bread. And it was quite good. And I used to eat this, and all right, you could get by on it all day. We did get other meals later on in the day, of course, but I found it difficult to eat some of this stuff. Cachofas, artichokes, and rota, rice. And in the rice were some flecks of fish and that sort of thing. And I wasn't too fond of the midday meal. It was partly the fact that it was cooked in olive oil or mixed with olive oil, and this didn't really form the basis of a good meal. I think some of the chaps in the contingent later on got their own hard rations like rice, and they cooked it English style milk pudding with some sultanas in it, and that was really good. So partly it was the fact that we weren't accustomed to eating the Spanish style. When we were able to get the basics stuff and cook it our way, it went down a lot better.
When you got there, were you attached to a unit or what?
Yes, we were a brigade, I think. But they didn't split us up. You know, they didn't sort of say, well, we'll assimilate you and put one Englishman here and then a few more Spaniards or French or whatever. No, they left us as a team because they thought that it would be better, and they're probably right. For morale, if we went as an entity, although from the point of view of assimilation and finding out things about Spain and the Spaniards, it probably added to our insularity.
Were you just with Spaniards or other nationalities?
No, there were other nationalities there. French, Romanian, Italian, a couple of Americans. Yes, there were other nationalities. Yugoslav, I remember. Yeah, there were all sorts of people there. But these were in one or twos, you know, they didn't come in bunches.
So most of the troops there were Spaniards?
Ah, mostly Spaniards, yes. Yes, the next in charge was a Romanian, a chap called Benjamin. Then there was Kopp, George Kopp, who was the commander. And he was a Belgian. And he was a Belgian businessman that was motivated, I think, first of all, to smuggle arms into Spain. But he got so wound up in the cause that eventually he joined and became part of the fighting units. And at the end of the war, he was very unfortunate, and he spent a long time in a concentration camp. And when I saw him a long time after the war had finished, he had changed from a plump, jolly sort of chap to, I really wouldn't have recognised him, a most pale and emaciated sort of chap. It was rather a shame that he had such a tough time. Quite a brave sort of bloke. He did one or two perhaps foolhardy things, but he was quite he's capable of saying, come on, we'll be all right, let's go down and do this. He gave confidence and encouragement, which, funnily enough, is only given to some men, isn't it? Some you're always suspicious of, but funnily enough, Kopp and George Orwell too were the sort of men that you would go with quite happily, knowing that they knew that bit more than you did, and so you know you could rely on them.
So Benjamin and Kopp were in charge, were they?
Well, Benjamin was the sort of corporal, if you like, but Kopp was in charge. He was the commander, really.
Who was Kopp in charge of, exactly?
Well, he was in charge of the ourselves and the contingent, of course, and other Spanish units, is the best thing I can describe them as. You see, it wasn't like regiments and battalions and things that we knew them. It's not really an army. It was a militia. And I think the difference is that with the militia, there's a lot of informality and reliance on response to meet the exigencies of the situation, rather than the rank type of thing which you get in the army. In some ways, it makes for a bit of a messy-minded situation, because, for example, in later, when I was in the RAF, and I was a sergeant, I could say to the chap in charge of the flare path when it wasn't a light, you get in like that flare path, or you're on a fizzer, Kelly, now get at it, you know. And I could back it up, and I knew that by saying that, I had the whole of the, if you like, police side of the RAF with me. So I knew that if it ever came to that, I had that. Very rarely did. Blokes used to carry on as they did in the militia. But I'm surprised that the military thing worked as well as it did in the militia, really, because it could have been a lot more difficult. If a few people had said, well, why the hell should we? It could have been very dangerous. But in the event, it wasn't too bad. They were very slap-happy about guns and bombs in a way which could be frightening. You know, accident-prone, if you like, but which could have been prevented quite easily.
Such as?
Well, now and again it so happened that if you drop a rifle, the stock of the rifle, the butt of the rifle, on the ground, it had a habit of going off. You know, the thing was that delicate or badly constructed. Probably wouldn't happen normally, but several times it happened there. So you say, well, look, don't do that. But whether out of boredom or lack of appreciation of what happened, they would. A lot of blokes inflicted wounds on themselves accidentally. I mean, blokes, bolts blowing back and, you know, damaging head and shoulder.
Can you give any specific examples?
No, not really, except that did happen. I mean, that is a specific example. Another one. Damaged his shoulder.
How did that happen?
There must have been a dozen of these things, really, in that period, in those few months. Mainly because the equipment wasn't very, very efficient. I mean, we can talk about the equipment, just digressing.
Yes.
The sort of guns we had were Mausers, mostly. Those old German Mausers, you know, going 1890s sort of thing. Some of them were the long Mausers, and the others were the short, which I think is often used in cavalry, aren't they? You know, they fire from the shoulder, so there were some of those. And there were one or two Winchesters. But I think the Winchesters, you had to fire single shots. And somehow they unloaded from beneath, whereas the bolt was on the top. The other ones, these things had a sort of thing underneath. And the Mausers, which when they jammed, which they frequently did, had to be cleared by a ramrod, which you had to find somebody else that had got the ramrod. Different people had it in different times. Generally in Spain, the sort of chap in charge, the captain or the whoever, whatever his rank may be, had a ramrod and cleared it. There was never any gun inspection, for example, which is pretty essential that you have a... I mean, a rifle won't fire properly, will it? Unless it's properly rifled and the inside of it is cleaned, and they just weren't. And we didn't know anything about it.
Did you clean the guns?
Hardly at all. We tried sometimes, but they had nothing to clean them with. You used olive oil. So I think somebody kept a tin of Vaseline. One or two of them had a bit of Vaseline, but you had no rags, for example. You usually kept an old handkerchief thing. Very often, I wasn't very good at... I hadn't the experience to look down and say, yeah, that's all right. A couple of them had. Donovan had. George Orwell, who had done some OTC at Eton. He looked down and he'd say, my God, you know, it's terrible again.
Now, coming on to George Orwell, can you tell me how you first met him?
Yes, he didn't go over to Spain with the contingent, like the rest of us. He joined us whilst we were in Spain. And I remember one morning, he appeared on the scene with a chap called Williams, who was married to a Spanish girl, and they were both present at the breakfast where we got the coffee and the rolls in the morning. And he was much taller than the average Englishman, and he had an eaten cut glass accent that made him unmistakably English. You don't hear it quite so much now as you did then. It was undoubtedly very English and rather superior sounding, which some people, of course, particularly in the proletarian circles, wasn't particularly well liked. I found him then quite approachable. He just spoke to everybody. And you could tell by the way he looked at you that he would remember. And he did. He was very memorable about people. He was different from the rest of us in his discipline, in that as a writer he did, and I have seen him, set aside periods to write during the day which other people would have found highly inconvenient. He'd sort of prop up anywhere and write, and it wasn't very long before he was doing just that after our breakfast. And
where was this breakfast?
This was in the La Granca, just outside in El Kabiri.
You said that he was tall.
Tall, yes.
Can you give some more details about his physical appearance?
Well, I believe he was more than 6 foot. He was 6 foot three, 6 foot four, probably. And it was his height which was such a significant factor when he was shot, because had he been shorter, the bullet would have gone right through his head and he would undoubtedly have been killed. His brain would have been blown out. But being so tall, the bullet, one of these miraculous escapes again, went right through his throat, missing the jugular cord, the spinal cord, the windpipe. It just went through. And apart from losing blood and it affecting his voice a bit, he spoke with a rather higher-pitched voice afterwards, a weaker voice, which was a very small complication when you consider that he was shot through the neck. So that the thing that we thought would make him tall when he appeared above the parapets and would therefore likely to make him be shot, in actual fact saved his life.
Did you see him shot?
No, I wasn't present when he was shot. But Frankfurt was present, and he gives an account of it.
I asked you about his appearance, apart from his height. Can you go into that?
Apart from his height, yes, he was a slim, slim sort of man. And I would say that he was the sort of chap that could sell you things if he was a salesman. He was an influential person, or a person capable of influencing. Oh, in many ways. He could tell people off without overdoing it. I mean, I can recall a Spaniard that had a dog, and he was... it seemed to be the fashion then to write things with pokers on dogs, like CNT, Thigh, Poom, Sook, all these political initials got engraved on the back of some poor dog. Well, this bloke was dragging the dog along. He goes over and he says, sort of in Spanish, which he spoke some of, you know, I don't do that, the dog doesn't like this, and so forth. But without overdoing it, you know, he patted the bloke and he chatted sort of to the chap. And he had this way of, I suppose whether you call it the common touch, he could make his point nicely very often, although he could be quite unpleasant in the threatening sense. I recall one occasion when we were in the British Embassy just as we were leaving Spain, and there was a chap who was suggesting that George Orwell's wife, who was with us in Barcelona and looked after our money sometimes, and the blokes went to a rather than carry their money around, she would sort of give them it as it was required. And he insisted, this chap insisted, that he had more money than there actually was. And he was saying this, that, I thought I had more left, I thought there was some there. And typical Orwell, he says, now look here, if you're saying that Eileen's had your money, then say so. And if you want money, tell us and we'll get you some. But don't hint and miss.